You are listening to Conversations in the Gospel of John. This is episode 11. This episode was recorded in the spring of 2024 at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to Conversations in the Gospel of John, where we want and hope to bridge the gap between current academic research and contemporary proclamation of this wonderful text. My name is Stan Harstein, and my co-host is Douglas Estes.
Hi, I'm Douglas, and I currently teach at Friends University.
And I'm also at Friends University. Our guest today is Alan Culpepper, and just for full disclosure, when I was studying at Baylor University, Alan was one of my major professors, if not the major professor. I've known him for a long time, and we are blessed to have him here today. We're also changing up the topic of our conversation because we're not going to talk about a particular text, but we're going to talk about his career and how his career has tried to bridge the gap between academic research and the pulpit. So, Alan, how would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you today and delighted to be with Stan and Douglas and be able to talk about the Gospel of John, which has been really a kind of lifelong pursuit. I am, just in terms of personal identity, a missionary kid. My parents were missionaries in South America, and I lived there most of the first 10 years of my life. My father then finished a degree in missions and taught missions, and I went to Baylor University and Southern Baptist Seminary in Kentucky and Duke University, and then taught at the Southern Seminary 4.5 years or so at Baylor University, and then became the founding dean of the School of Theology at Mercer University in Atlanta, the McAfee School of Theology. So I have grown up really in the shadow of theological education and grew into that tradition where I found my own calling and identity. I'm married, have two wonderful children, three grandchildren. My wife is also an educator, taught education at Mercer University while we were there. And we retired in 2016 and moved to Lake Hartwell and live in the woods on the lake here. So we get, whenever we can, some lake time for fishing and sailing, and look forward to times when we have the grandchildren here to enjoy it with us.
So one of the first questions we usually start with is, what got you interested in studying the Gospel of John in the first place?
I originally felt like I was called to ministry, and have felt that all my life, and thought that would lead to pastoral ministry. I was a pastor briefly as a student, but my first semester at Southern Seminary, I had William E. Hull, Bill Hull, for a course on the Gospel of John. And we used Raymond Brown's Anchor Bible Commentary, the first volume of it. The second volume hadn't come out yet, but we read all of the first volume for the first 12 chapters and then didn't have anything comparable to it really for the second half of the Gospel. But between Hull is a very gifted professor who was himself writing the Broadman Bible Commentary on John at that point in his life, and Raymond Brown as the textbook, and the Gospel of John as the subject matter, I was hooked. Here was something that was fascinating, intriguing, complicated, spiritually uplifting, theologically profound, and the blending of the intellectual and spiritual in the study as well as in the text itself really drew me into it.
It's always wonderful to have good instructors because they're often those who pique our interest. And I'm sure over your career, you now would say you have figured out everything there is to know about the Gospel of John, correct? As he smiles and probably...
You know, as you well know, we work and work and work and keep discovering every time we come into it and dig into it and never feel like we've really gotten to the bottom of it.
A lot has changed in how people approach the Gospel of John through that time. You did some original work on the Johannine school, and there's always talks about, you know, where were the Gospels written, but then you kind of shifted focus and started a avalanche, we could call it, of studies in looking at John as a text and what the text does. So what were you feeling way back there at the beginning of your career? You had a newly minted PhD, you were teaching at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, as it is referred to, officially in title. What caused you, or what led you to kind of change methodology?
Well, after graduating from Southern Seminary, I went to Duke University, really to study with W.D. Davies in Jewish materials, Jewish background, and Moody Smith, D. Moody Smith, an up-and-coming, if not already well-established figure in Johannine scholarship. In working in that double connection of historical setting and Johannine studies, I became intrigued with the idea and really the significance of the Johannine school, and kept seeing references here. And so I wrote a dissertation trying to establish if there was a school, what kind of school, what do we mean by Johannine school? Various authors use it in different ways in their various historical models. And so while I was doing that, J. Lewis Martin had already published History and Theology in the Fourth Gospel, which took us in a very vivid, sort of intentionally dramatic way into the Johannine community and the way the Gospel of John tells both about what happened in the ministry of Jesus and gives a reflection of what was happening at the time John was written in that community. And shortly thereafter, of course, Raymond Brown followed with the community of the beloved disciple. So there was a lot of interest at that time in the Johannine community, and my dissertation on the school, I think, fit into that period. But having written that, several things began to happen. There was one of my friends at Duke and contemporaries there was David Rhodes. And we would have coffee every morning and talk about the Johannine school. And he was writing on Israel and Revolution, working with W.D. Davies. He went on to Kenosha College in Wisconsin, taught the Gospel of Mark with an English professor, and saw a new world of the Gospel of Mark as a literary text and how a professor of literature read and interpreted the gospel. That led to his book, Mark as Story. And back in those days, we didn't have email, we didn't have cell phones. But David and I ran up quite a telephone bill with late night conversations talking about Mark and John and literary approach, which we decided we would call narrative criticism. I had a sabbatical. There was already the parables group in the SBL was with John Dominic Croson and others looking at the parables as stories. And there was a new literary aspects of the Gospels and Acts group in the SBL, and they were working. But nobody was doing that with John. Historically, innovations and new methodologies in New Testament begin in Mark. And I thought, good, well, I'll run over to John, back to my home territory, and see what it looks like. So I had a sabbatical leave in Cambridge, 1980-81, contacted Frank Kermode, who had just written a book on Mark, the Genesis of Secrecy. And he was very gracious in making time for conversation, welcoming me into his circle of advanced students and guiding my work. He would say, well, have you read this or this and this? And I'd go over to this Cambridge library and look at everything within 5 feet of those titles. Mm-hmm. And that was my introduction into literary theory.
I think it just shows the importance of connections, that no one of us ever has the whole picture on what's happening. No one of us has the whole methodology behind us, and we are really inspired by those people we interact with, which I think is one of the reasons that we have to bridge the academic into what I would say the congregation, because if we're not interacting with others of interest, we kind of become isolated, and that's not always a positive thing. So you wrote a book which has been quoted frequently. So tell us about its reception and what kind of changes you saw happening, or lack of change happening.
Having written The Johannine School, I was nervous and dissatisfied, frankly, with using the text simply as a database to try to probe behind it. So we were looking at the community, we were looking at the history, we were looking at how it was composed. And I thought, well, before we do that, we really ought to look at the gospel itself and see how it works, how it's put together, how it functions as a piece of literature, narrative, a coherent narrative. And it was Kermode then who guided me into that. And I wrote Anatomy of the Fourth Gospel. Anatomy picking up both on the title of a book by Northrop Frye, but Anatomy of Criticism, but also Moody Smith, the textbook, college textbook, Anatomy of the New Testament. So it seemed to work. But I was now looking at new categories as far as Johannine studies, at least the narrator, characters, plot, implicit commentary, implied reader. Those were not terms that had been used in Johannine studies previously.
Right, and those are all each their own kind of field of study at times now, but you covered them all in the book and let it out. And so how was the book received back in those early days? Because I will admit, I was just graduating college in 1982 and wasn't aware of it because I was a math major at that point in time.
We were, David Rhodes and I and Norman Peterson and Elizabeth Malvin and just a number of others were the Young Turks at that point, because historical criticism was not just a method, it was the recognized method for scholarship on the New Testament. And I was not, and I think we were not challenging it to say it's inappropriate. We were just saying that method takes a particular angle of vision on the text, and we're going to take a different one. I think that they're in fact both important, and the text is obviously written in a given time and period for readers. They have to be able to understand it. It's set in a historical period. But the effort is not to get behind the text to say, well, who was the historical Jesus or the evangelist or the community, but how does the Gospel of John work in communicating its message to us, which I think is a much more compatible approach for the church than is historical criticism, which inescapably has to be based on examination of text and bias and prejudice and historicity. And those are not unimportant, but they're not the sort of natural raw material for sermons.
Yeah, and I think that what you did really is reflected in the pastoral work that happens, that each pastor brings a particular viewpoint based on their own community's life. The factors that they're engaged in shape the sermon. There's not just one sermon that can be preached on John chapter 2. There are a multitude, and by saying there's only one way to view the scripture is to say there's only one valid way, and there are so many different ones. And so I think it was very important, and I can't not mention that as you're talking about how John works, that sitting across from me is a individual who has a book out called How John Works. It's important that we are always asking new questions and pursuing those, and we don't get away from historical questions. And when we find new things, we have to understand them.
to circle back a little bit, one of the things that is distinctive about the Gospel of John and that drew me to it is that it is written really with an emphasis or with attention to what Jesus means in the life of the church, to put it in those terms. But think about this a minute. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't have a farewell discourse. What they have is an eschatological discourse. They have Jesus on the Mount of Olives talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the coming of the Son of Man. You go to the Gospel of John, there's no eschatological discourse. And in place of it, on the night before he's arrested, you have a farewell discourse in which he talks to the disciples, but often talks about the time of the church, so that the time is sort of blended and overlapped and interwoven, and you get the connection between the historical setting and the life of the church. Picking up on the title I gave to the collection of my essays, Designs for the Church in the Gospel of John. I think especially the later chapters and the crucifixion and the resurrection appearances are written not just to give historical narration, but to reflect pretty directly and openly the significance of those events for the church. And John does that in a way that is unique among the Gospels.
It does. It's very different in terms of just his perspective. And that's why, as you noted, nobody had applied this material to John, because at that point in time, John was left out of most discussions because it was so different from the synoptics. They couldn't find a place for it. And now we're finding that it's maybe have some of the most relevant historical information, the most geographically accurate information about Jerusalem that 60 years ago wouldn't have crossed their mind. Yeah, the Designs for the Church is 40 years of your essays and a well-written volume, because it was written over 40 years in the making. So as we talk about literary criticism and just its role, during your time as a dean, you were in lots of churches in and around the state of Georgia, in Atlanta, and other places in the southeast of the U.S. How do you see literary criticism, narrative criticism, being utilized in churches by pastors in the sermons that they're taking, or even in the questions that they're asking? What did you encounter in that regard while you were there?
Well, there are parallels in the field of homiletics, and particularly Fred Craddock, who was here, of course, in Georgia, and I had the distinct privilege of getting to know, and he taught some or gave lectures some at the School of Theology. Fred moved away from the three points in a poem approach to preaching.
Can I say hallelujah?
And made the sermon often a story, a narrative, in which he would or at least it had major narrative components. People remember stories. People enjoy stories. And stories can be interwoven with one another. And stories from today and stories from the Bible can be interwoven. It makes for very creative preaching. So I wouldn't take the apparatus of narrative criticism into the pulpit. I didn't come in and talk about the narratee and the implied author and the plot. That's the stuff you do in the study. That's not what you do in the pulpit. But appreciation for the story, for suspense, for intrigue, for symbolism, for climax, resolution, conflict. When you pay attention to those things, you do see the Gospels, in particular, the Gospel stories, in a different light that often opens up real possibilities for some creative preaching.
Douglas, I think you had a question you wanted to ask.
Yeah, I had a couple. We can do one or two. Let me start with a story in good narrative style before I ask my question. When I was doing my THM, This would be in the late 90s. I was reading Alan's book. I had read Adele Reinhart's article in JBL that was just really sensational. And so I had decided to do my THM in a literary approach to John. And my advisor was David Beck, who studied under D. Moody Smith at Duke. And when I was in the process of looking to do my PhD, for sure, like I was really committed to this route now, I remember that I talked to a senior scholar, and they asked me, what was I going to do with my PhD? And I told them that I was going to do a literary focus on John, probably temporality. And they said to me, oh, that's a fad. That's such a bad idea. It's a fad. So I'm just curious, Alan, how much pushback did you get originally? Did you have people tell you that you were engaging in a fad or anything like that? I'm just curious that some of the negative comments that you may have gotten.
Absolutely. And you know, that goes back to the question Stan raised about reception. This was a new thing. And I wrote it in Cambridge and had the privilege of attending the Cambridge New Testament Seminar. Historical meeting goes back over a century, and they meet fortnightly in the Divinity School. But I was working with Frank Kermode over in the English department at King's College, and they were not doing anything remotely related to what I was doing. And I had to be a little circumspect even about telling them what I was doing, because it was just off the chart. It was, oh, you're one of those lit crit fellows, aren't you? And then in publication here, it was seen either as non-critical or it was not really a good biblical scholarship, because it was, you know, that literary stuff. So those of us I mentioned earlier in the Gospels and Acts, literary aspects of the Gospels and Acts, we were really a small sort of group of young Turks battling for a place to be heard, a platform, an approach, a way of dealing with the text. What happened was that things changed quickly and very quickly, so that in a sense, before there was really a thorough exploration of the potential of narrative criticism, we were off into post-structuralism, ideological criticism, reader response criticism, gender-related criticisms. Once the hegemony of historical criticism was cracked, the field took off in many directions. It just opened the floodgates for all kinds. Some of it's been very helpful, some less helpful, I think, and we're still in the process of sorting that out. But I would also say that it left room for now, some years later, 40 years later, to go back and pick up some of the potential of those early works that haven't thoroughly been explored.
Okay, good. Let me ask one more question then, since we've got a couple more minutes. You were the pioneer of literary criticism in the Gospel of John, and 40 or so years onward, what is one area that hasn't really been developed, or maybe an area of study that we could have gone down, a road that we didn't take?
There have been specialized studies, especially on symbolism. It took several decades, but then a wave of literature on characterization that I think has been productive. Quickly, work on irony and symbolism, some work on the reader, some work on plot and story. So those things. And I don't know that I've got a crisp answer for you, but I do think that the ways in which history and literature intersect, and it intersects in various ways. Narrative criticism is not anti-historical, but it uses history or pays attention to history for purposes and in ways that are different from historical criticism. If you don't pay any attention to it, then you're going to be reading it, as sometimes we have been charged with doing, and anachronistically viewing it as though it were a 20th century novel, which it is not, and so forth. No, it is a piece of literature written in the first century, and you have to read it in that context, which means you have to pay attention to history. But you're not doing history for the same purposes that the historical critics were. But there's some room for overlap there. I think that that whole area still has some fertile ground for exploration.
Okay, great. I agree.
You agree. You're always so short well, when you get to the end of it.
I want to be crisp. No, and that was I thought that was a great answer, Alan, because it's hard, you know, to... I feel like this movement has not done, and I agree, there's a lot of nuanced work that needs to go into how do we meld these two concepts, history and literature, in a way that's, you know, it's not a 20th century novel, but, you know, obviously it contains history. How do we communicate that well? And that just takes a lot of time to nuance that correctly.
I should add, as you all know, I've never done a major commentary on John, but I did on each of the synoptics, most recently Matthew, and this week I have a book coming out of the print shop or the printers at Westminster, John Knox, entitled The People of the Parables, Galilee in the Time of Jesus, which in a way takes me full circle back to historical material, and there's certainly going to be room there for what I did was to devote a chapter to each of the characters in Jesus' parables to have as full a sense of fishermen, tax collectors, women, sowers, vineyard workers, on and on, because that's the kind of history and historical data that the hearers of Jesus, as well as some of the readers, at least, would have been familiar with. That was the world in which they lived. And that could give us a richer context then for reading not only John, but all the Gospels.
Right. And I think what that illustrates is that at the beginning of your career, and even up through the beginning of my career, the history we knew was that of the elites in society. And historical studies outside of the Bible have gone to trying to find out as much as they can about the common person. And by doing the study that you've done on the parable and identifying all that information, we can move away from an elitist view of what's going on in the Gospels and really get a down-to-earth, humble people, and maybe change how we perceive those individuals that Jesus was interacting with, which would then change how we view what he's saying to them. That's a very valuable type of work. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing to our audience?
Well, I appreciate the conversation today, and I have the greatest admiration for those of you who are in the pulpits week after week, bringing pastoral care and preaching a strong word of the gospel. We need that kind of voice of witness. We need theologians in the community. We need people who are helping us make sense and not be misguided by the political turbulence and the cultural debates of our time. And I don't know a more important place for that to happen than in the pulpit.
Well, that's a very good word. We have a lot of voices in our heads about what should and shouldn't be, and sometimes we just have to come back to what is and what the biblical teaching helps us understand so we can become a community of people. We can't be divided among ourselves and still be whole. So we do want to thank you for taking time to join us, and for those who are listening, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining Douglas and I on Conversations in the Gospel of John. If you have any comments, you can email us at cgj@stanharstein.com. Our next guest will be Craig Kester, Emeritus Professor of New Testament at Luther Seminary. We hope you'll join us. Bye now.